So it's my pleasure today to introduce my colleague, Dr. Jason Jewell. Dr. Jewell is the chairman of the Department of Humanities at Faulkner University. He received a PhD in humanities from Florida State University, an MA in history from Pepperdine University, and a bachelor's in history and music from Harding University. Dr. Jewell coordinates the Western Cultural Heritage course sequence at Faulkner, and he also teaches European history courses in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences and Great Books courses in the Great Books Honors College. Dr. Jewell is co-director of the Faulkner Patristics Project in Faulkner's Bible College, and he's also associate editor of the Journal of Faith in the Academy. He's an associated scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and his research interests include religion and politics in early modern Britain, the Christian philosophy of history, and the intersection of Christianity and culture. He's contributor to a book called Christian Faith and Social Justice. And social justice is, as we all know, his topic for the day. So I just want to say a few words before I yield the floor or the podium to Jason here. And I borrow these ideas from Hayek. This is actually a copy of the second volume of Friedrich Hayek's Law, Legislation, and History. And the second volume is titled The Mirage of Social Justice. So anyone familiar with Hayek, and in particular Law, Legislation, and Liberty, knows that sort of the basic premise of the book is that humans are mostly ignorant about the particular facts that motivate other people. Nevertheless, many of them suffer from the delusion that they can assemble a surveyable whole of all the data in the social order and thus can rationally plan or centrally design a workable system for all possible scenarios in society. But as Hayek liked to point out, knowledge is decentralized and dispersed across society. No one human mind can possess the aggregated knowledge of an entire polity. So today, Jason's topic is about justice and social justice, justice being something like an outcome that is impartial, morally fair and correct, social justice involving the redistribution of wealth and privilege in society. And I want to read just a few lines from Hayek. So Hayek says, only human conduct can be called just or unjust. If we apply the terms to a state of affairs, they have meaning only insofar as we hold someone responsible for bringing it about or allowing it to come about. A bare fact or a state of affairs which nobody can change may be good or bad, but not just or unjust. Unless we believe that somebody could and should have arranged things differently, it is meaningless to describe a factual situation as just or unjust. So in other words, justice is a term with moral import. We assign terms of moral import to decisions, to human choices, to human agency, something that is just an inadvertent byproduct of natural circumstances that was not that chosen cannot be called just or unjust meaningfully. One more quote. Statements which explicitly connect social and distributive justice with the treatment by society of the individuals according to their deserts bring out most clearly its difference from plain justice, and at the same time the cause of the vacuity of the concept. The demand for social justice is addressed not to the individual but to society, yet society in the strict sense in which it must be distinguished from the apparatus of government is incapable of acting for a specific purpose, and the demand for social justice therefore becomes a demand that the members of society should organize themselves in a manner which makes it possible to assign particular shares of the product of society to different individuals or groups. Here to clarify that is Dr. Jason Jewell. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Jewell.
So my topic today, which Alan chose for me, is social justice versus justice. And I've been writing and speaking about this idea of social justice for several years now. It's really remarkable to me how much of a moving target the concept seems to be, depending on whom you talk to. It seems to some extent that people will call or put the name social justice on just whatever social outcome they would prefer to see. You know, social justice is whatever I want. You know, so that's not a very helpful definition, obviously. Other people will put all kinds of, you know, academic language surround these concepts with that, and we'll look at that a little bit here. But it has, the phrase social justice has been around for more than 100 years, but it's been used in significantly different ways by different writers and different public figures. So what I'm hoping to do today is to lay out some of these definitions in a way that has some nuance and explain which of these definitions I think might actually be helpful for us to think about seriously and which maybe are not so much. So I've just completed a stint as a visiting scholar at the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal in Macosta, Michigan. Some of you are familiar with the name Russell Kirk, I'm sure. And I've been immersed in Kirk's writing for the past few months. So I'd like to start with an anecdote that he relates in the chapter from the 1954 book, A Program for Conservatives, the chapter that's titled The Problem of Social Justice. So Kirk writes that he has a friend in Scotland who has the misfortune of owning a number of stone cottages. Why is this a misfortune? Well, the misfortune results from the fact that the cottages' rents have been legally fixed at the 1914 rates, which was 5 shillings per week. Now, in 1954, according to Kirk, 5 shillings was about 70 cents per week. So you may know that the British government went off, you know, back in 1914, 5 shillings was, you know, a decent amount of money. But in World War I, the British government went off the gold standard. It tried to reestablish it during the 1920s, but really bungled that, and then failed to maintain the gold standard during the Great Depression. So by 1954, the British pound had depreciated to about, or less than a quarter of what it had been worth in 1914. And in case you're wondering, the 2019 value of the pound is less than 1% of what it was in 1914. But back to Kirk's story. The cost of maintaining these cottages exceeded the income generated from the rents received. So Kirk's friend was operating at a loss, even without taking into account his own time and effort. In fact, the value of the rent was so small that Kirk's friend allowed elderly or infirm people to stay rent-free in some of the cottages. On the other hand, several of the cottagers were able-bodied and employed at decent wages. In fact, the typical Scottish worker in 1954 was working shorter hours and getting better wages than ever before. So he was perfectly capable of paying the rent, or so you would think. Kirk's friend had an agent who would visit the cottage, all the cottages every week, to collect the 5 shillings that were due from the tenants. And on one occasion, a tenant came to the door and refused to pay his rent, saying that he had decided not to pay rent at all from that point forward because he couldn't afford it. And Kirk records the following exchange. The agent asks the tenant, "Will you be honest with me?" The tenant said yes. And the agent says, "Well then, how much do you spend a month on cigarettes?" 30 shillings, replied the tenant, in righteous defiance. "And not a penny more." And Kirk goes on to say, "When a man feels that he's entitled to withhold his rent, though he spends on tobacco 50% more per month than he does on his cottage, his notion of justice seems to be confused." That's putting it rather mildly, I would say. But of course, one of the leading theories of social justice that's offered to us in the modern world, the Marxist theory, holds that landlords are the most vicious and exploitative people in the economy. And one could easily imagine a Marxist applauding this cottager for sticking it to the man and refusing to pay his rent. standing up to that landlord, who, as Kirk says, is not subsidized by anyone, works longer hours than his tenants and has no time to tend his own garden, has sold off many of his family's assets in order to pay for his children's education, and faces the prospect of a ruinous inheritance tax that will force his family to sell most of their land in order to pay it once he dies. Why does all this happen? Well, according to Kirk, it's the ascendancy of the idea that justice consists in leveling. Okay, now leveling as social justice is a major theme in public discourse today. However, this was not always the case. The earliest use of the phrase social justice dates to the middle of the 19th century. It was a significant element of a treatise titled A Theoretical Treatise on Natural Law Resting on Fact. They always had really long and cumbersome titles in the, you know, back before the 20th century, as you know. But this was written by a Jesuit priest named Luigi Taparelli. And I'm indebted to Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, some of you know him, for alerting me to the existence of this work. Apparently Ryan wrote a lot of his dissertation on this piece. Taparelli was responding to social contract theorists like John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and offering a theory of society allegedly based on the facts of history rather than the fiction of the social contract. You know, Taparelli said, well, we all know nobody ever, you know, got together and made a social contract to create society and to create government. So we've got then Taparelli saying, that's why his title says resting on facts. Like, I'm not making up social contract nonsense here. This is how society actually formed. Taparelli argued that society in the broad sense, what he called the larger society, which is all of us everywhere, is made up of small societies that predate the large society, and that the large society is really a creature of and is dependent on those small societies. So there are many of these, what we might call small s societies, as opposed to a capital S society, and that the state has a duty to respect these small societies. Each one has a legitimate function that should not be disturbed by the state. And Taparelli had a view of justice that is broader than that of simply following the written law. He's not a legal positivist. He followed an older view of justice in the natural law tradition of writers like Thomas Aquinas, that there is a natural justice that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the written law or having anything to do with the state, and we should be in pursuit of this natural justice. So I hope you'll forgive me because I originally wrote this talk for economists and not for lawyers. So if my legal terminology is not just so, then I hope you'll forgive me since I'm not an attorney myself. So this natural justice does include a distributive component, according to Taparelli. And he used this phrase, social justice, to recover the idea that he thought had disappeared from the thought of the social contract theorists who didn't really recognize anything between the individual and the state. So if you're familiar with Locke or Rousseau or these other social contract writers, they just say there's a bunch of disaggregated individuals out there and their lives become unsatisfying for some reason, so they get together and they have this social contract, and then there's a government, and then the government mediates among the individuals. But Taparelli says, well, what about all the, what sociologists call the mediating institutions? What about the church and the family and unions and trade associations and all these other kinds of things that have a real existence that are in pursuit of legitimate social ends? The modern political theorists, to a great extent, that rely on ideas like the social contract don't really have anything to say about those things. But Taparelli and the more traditional view of society says, no, you've got to have, you got to take account of these societies, these organizations. If you are familiar with the writings of the conservative sociologist Robert Nisbet, you know, for example, in the 20th century, this was a big theme of his in books like The Quest for Community. So this social justice idea from Topparelli and the older Christian natural law tradition, it goes something like this, the way they would frame this. Human flourishing is a natural and appropriate goal. It's fitting to our nature. And human beings need property in order to flourish. We have to make use of material resources. This includes not only the basic needs of food and clothing and shelter, but also things that will permit us to flourish in a higher sense. And because property is scarce, we need some kind of rules to sort out how it's going to be distributed among ourselves and how it's going to be used. Now, there's a long-standing recognition going all the way back to writers like Aristotle that private ownership of property is a superior arrangement for handling the distribution of property as opposed to some kind of collective ownership. There's all kinds of problems with collective ownership that I'm sure you're familiar with. I won't go into those details. But Topparelli and this natural law tradition recognize this fact. Private ownership is the way to go. But the private ownership of property carries certain moral obligations along with it, because the earthly owners of property, and speaking here from a specifically Christian view, the earthly owners of property are in reality stewards of what ultimately belongs to God, right? So when you own property, but you're obligated morally to use it in an appropriate way that's in keeping with the natural law and with the divine law as well. So the private owner has a duty to be attentive to the needs of other people who are around him, and keep in mind, you know, what kind of benefit could others have from, I mean, if they had the use of the property that I own. And so there ought to be a willingness to marshal your own resources and use that property for the benefit of others, and to give out of surplus when there is a demonstrated need. But what is this surplus? How do you know? How do you judge this? And so this natural law tradition, writers like Thomas Aquinas would say, there are basically three kinds of goods that you could own. One kind of good, one category, is the bare necessities for your own survival and the survival of your family, your household, and maintenance. So there's never an obligation, according to this way of thinking, to give up those resources or that property in the name of justice. Then there's a second category of property, which would be the property that's necessary to maintain you in your occupation or your social standing. So whatever property is fitting for you in your particular walk of life, you know, for, you know, a farmer, this might be a tractor. For a scholar, it could be books. For attorneys, I don't know, what do attorneys need? You guys, I'm sure you could all come up with a long list. But he said, okay, so that's a second category of property, and normally there's no obligation for you to surrender that property or give that away either, because this is necessary to maintain you in your social sphere. Now, there is some prudence that needs to be exercised here, and some self-reflection and honest examination of what is really necessary. You get the picture. But then the third category would be excess beyond those first two things. And Thomas Aquinas and other writers in this tradition would say, you need to be willing to use those resources on behalf of others when there is a need. Now, that doesn't mean you just go out and give it all away. There's no duty to be profligate in that sense. To the contrary, there is a moral obligation for you as the giver of a resource or potential giver of a resource to make sure that it is employed in an effective and an efficient way that is not, you know, destructive to the recipients. So you can probably see how the institution of markets would fit into this, how markets discipline participants in that system to use their resources in efficient ways. Now, notice all this is natural justice. This has nothing to do with the state, with the government. This is all things that you are making the best judgment that you can honestly through this process of reflection and using the property that has been delegated to you by God for what you consider to be the best purposes. So this is a vision of executing that Christian obligation of loving one's neighbor. That's what all this is sort of directed towards, within one's own circle of social influence. And people like Topperelli would say, well, this kind of redistribution of wealth, if you want to call it that, is going to happen within these small s societies. It's going to happen within extended families, within the church, within other kinds of voluntary associations, within social networks. We don't necessarily have any kind of vision of an institution that comes in and forcibly takes things from some to hand it to other people. Nothing like that. So this is the vision of social justice that animates Topperelli's writing, and also the Roman Catholic principle of subsidiarity, with which I'm sure many of you are familiar. So Catholic writers took up this language of social justice. Topperelli was the first person to use that phrase, as far as we know. But a lot of other Catholic writers took up that language and continued to use it into the 20th century. And the so-called Catholic social teaching, beginning with Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum in 1891, makes use of this concept. And again, the stress here is not primarily on what the state does, but what all these small societies do and what sorts of obligations they have toward each other. So this is an important point. When Topperelli writes this treatise on natural law and he talks about this thing, social justice, he doesn't consider himself to be creating a new category of thinking or coming up with a new way of thinking about society, or thinking, hey, I've looked around and I see all these injustices that no one has seen before, and we've got to do all this stuff to try to correct these injustices. He's simply trying to extend what he thinks is already the accepted idea of justice that everybody agrees about, and just extending that into the social realm where social these small s societies are operating. So there's no big, you know, radical change in thinking about justice here. It's a natural extension, according to Topperelli. Now, so we've got the Catholic social teaching that makes use of this. Another example of that would be the distributist movement in the early 20th century. Some of you are familiar with that. Writers like G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, although those guys seem much more willing to use the state to break up what they consider to be unhealthy concentrations of wealth and have property more widely distributed throughout the society. But then when we get, say, around the 1930s or so, I'm not want to be too specific on pinpointing a date here, there is a shift in this how this language of social justice is used. And it's a shift towards what we would call the welfare state or just flat-out Marxism. And a lot of this comes out of the Great Depression, where a lot of people concluded that our problems are so big, our economic problems are so intense, that the state is the only institution that is large enough and can marshal enough resources in order to address these problems. Some of you may have heard of the radio priest, Father Charles Coughlin, who had a radio program with an estimated 40 million weekly listeners in the 1930s. So think about that. That's in a time when the population of the United States was maybe 100 million. And this guy has 40 million. Alan Brinkley, the son of David Brinkley, wrote a biography of Coughlin. And he said he had heard stories where people say, like in certain Midwestern cities, you could walk down the street and hear Coughlin's broadcast coming from a radio of from someone's open window. And you could walk all the way across town and never lose the train of thought from the broadcast, because somebody all the way along your route was listening to that broadcast with the volume turned up enough to where you could make it out from the street. So that's pretty remarkable. He had a very big influence in the 1930s. Now, Coughlin was deeply influenced by this tradition of Catholic social teaching, and he tried to promote it in his Detroit area parish, urging the auto manufacturers and the workers to follow the recommendations of Pope Leo XIII and other writers in this tradition. But unfortunately, if you may know, if you know anything about Coughlin, he also adopted some crackpot economic theories, wanted to nationalize industries and have large amounts of inflation. And then by the end of the 30s, he was veering into outright anti-Semitism, all kinds of crazy things. But he was under the impression that a lot of these policies would bring about the ends of Catholic social thought. But for this purposes of this talk, one of the most interesting things is, in addition to promoting these ideas through his radio program, he also formed an organization called the National Union for Social Justice. And he published a weekly newspaper called Social Justice. So he was the foremost promoter of this concept, of the particular idea of this redistribution idea of social justice. And so with figures like Coughlin, we can see how this older tradition of talking and writing about social justice is kind of morphing into what today we would call a very left-wing version. Social justice originates as a conservative idea, and then it becomes left-wing in the 20th century. But there are still some echoes of that older tradition of social justice writing by the mid-20th century, and that's showing up in the writings of people like Russell Kirk, and also Wilhelm Ripke. If you've never heard of Ripke before, he was a German economist who helped to engineer the post-war economic recovery in West Germany. Ripke wrote a book, A Humane Economy, in 1957. And in that book, he argued that it was necessary for wealthy people to shoulder the responsibility of patronizing the arts and funding socially desirable institutions that don't necessarily, quote, pay for themselves in the marketplace. Now, why would he write this? He's a free market economist. They only care about money, right? This is the caricature we often hear. Well, Ripke specifically says, if we want to maintain a free society, then we can't leave these gaps in society for the state, to tempt the state to come in and fill up in different ways. So he's saying to the wealthy people, you have an obligation to do this. You have a social and a moral obligation to use your wealth in this way. He called this not noblesse oblige, he called it richesse oblige, the obligation of rich people. Each must remain conscious of the responsibilities which his position entails. If ever the much abused words social justice are appropriate, it is here. That's a quote from Ripke. Right. So he's not afraid to use that phrase, but he also recognizes that it's been warped along the way by other people. But by the post-war situation, we've gotten to this situation that Russell Kirk decried, in which social justice is understood by many people simply as leveling, a redistribution of wealth from the relatively wealthy to the relatively poor. So most of the complaints about inequality that we encounter today can be traced to this leveling impulse. And of course, by now it's become a completely secularized concept. There's almost no remnant. I mean, of course, there are people on what we call the Christian left who say that, well, God wants us to be socialist. But for the most part, in mainstream public discourse, this is a completely secularized concept. Whereas Luigi Taparelli and Pope Leo XIII and other older writers advanced a Christian and a conservative vision of social justice, this newer incarnation of it borrows much more heavily from the ideas of the French Revolution and from atheistic socialist thinkers. So there are different manifestations of this impulse. Some are more extreme, some are more nuanced than others. And one of the crude manifestations of it on the political left is the vague idea that because X is good and it would be better for everybody to have X than for some people to have X and others not, then the state should just give X to everybody. So fill in the blank here, universal basic income, college education, birth control, whatever. And just take a look at the proposals that are being floated by the Democratic presidential contenders for the 2020 election, and you'll see many examples of this. So we could call this the I want a pony theory of social justice. Now, there is a more carefully nuanced version of this social justice theory on the left. It doesn't go all the way into Marxism, but I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about this one because I think it will be helpful to you to understand how a lot of these people think. It's the so-called capabilities theory that is advanced by writers like the philosopher Amartya Sen and the University of Chicago professor Martha Nussbaum. Some of you may have heard of Nussbaum before. She has a book that came out in 2013 called Creating Capabilities. And in that book, she offers a list of 10 areas that she calls central capabilities that, according to her, are essential to living a life with dignity. And she believes that social justice demands that the state work to ensure that every individual can exercise these 10 capabilities at or above a certain threshold. Now, I'm going to read off to you this list of 10 central capabilities, and I want you to think about what would it require in terms of state action to accomplish this vision. So here are the 10 central capabilities, according to Nussbaum. Life, that's number one. Number two is bodily health. Number three is bodily integrity. Number four is senses, imagination, and thought. Number five is emotions. Number six is practical reason. Number seven is affiliation. Number eight is other species. Number nine is play. P-L-A-Y, play. And number 10 is control over one's environment. Okay, wheels are turning. Seeing the federal budget grow by leaps and bounds here. Yeah, you may be hearing alarm bells go off in your mind. This list could be very useful for an individual who was seeking to organize his or her own life, either alone or in association with others. I mean, it's kind of an Aristotelian thing, right? What's necessary to human flourishing? I mean, we all like to have a certain threshold of play, I think, a certain threshold of emotional health. Who doesn't want that? All right, so there's nothing wrong with you maybe taking the things in that list and determining, you know, how, to what extent you should pursue each of those things and setting your own goals accordingly. But of course, if we're going to say this, all of these things become responsibilities of the state to ensure for citizens, then of course we're going to run into many, many problems. So there are some political, legitimate political goals in the list. I think we could probably all agree. But there's a problem in that there are some good things mixed in with some dubious things, even under the heading of the same capability in this list. So let me give you a couple of examples of this. Bodily integrity. Now, Nussbaum includes, under her understanding of bodily integrity, protection from violent assault, including sexual assault. Okay, well, that's certainly a good political goal, right? We should have laws that prevent or try to deter that sort of thing. But bodily integrity also, for Nussbaum, includes, here's a quote, having opportunities for sexual satisfaction and for choice in matters of reproduction. Now, that implies that Nussbaum believes at a minimum that the state should ensure access to abortion. How it's going to make sure everyone meets a certain threshold of opportunities for sexual satisfaction, I will leave to your imagination. Here's another example. Here's the capability. Senses, imagination, and thought. So under this capability, she includes guarantees of free speech and free religious exercise. Okay, so far so good. But we also find under this heading the ability to employ one's mind in a way informed and cultivated by an adequate education, and the ability to have pleasurable experiences and avoid non-beneficial pain. Sufficiently vague language for you to let your imaginations run wild, no doubt. Also in this category, we've got the capability of control over one's environment. So under this one, she includes property rights. Okay, that's great. She includes protection against unwarranted search and seizure. Sounds pretty good. But then there's also, here's a quote, being able to work as a human being, exercising practical reason, and entering into meaningful relationships of mutual recognition with other workers.
What if I want to present as an animal today?
Well, that's under the other species heading, yeah. All right, so you get the point here. This is very vague language. This can, it's very nebulous. You can always ratchet up what the threshold is that you think ought to be met in each of these areas. This is like an endless progressive dream, right? You can always set the threshold higher when you need to. It's a never-ending escalation. Now, of course, that was only the capabilities where you think, like, okay, maybe there's some good stuff in there, but maybe some problems. But then there's other capabilities where you just think, how on earth could the state do anything about that? Like emotional, making us all have a certain level of emotional satisfaction or emotional health. Capability of play, state-funded vacations for everybody, who knows? So it's very sweeping language, all kinds of, it's a minefield. And also it appears that according to Nussbaum's standards, if you've got to have all 10 of those things, central capabilities in order to live a life of dignity, there are probably very few people in the history of the world who have lived a life of dignity. All right, so this is a big problem. And she does say explicitly in her book, I have read much of this book, and she says explicitly that she thinks down the road, all these capabilities need to be guaranteed to non-human animals as well. So she's envisioning a situation where the state ultimately ends up with jurisdiction over every living thing on the planet. But when you strip away all the academic language, you're still down to that core idea that people deserve stuff and the state should give it to them. That's the social justice idea of the left. So different flavors and different variations of that idea have dominated the public debate on social justice since the middle of the 20th century. And this is what Hayek had in mind, getting back to Hayek now, when he attacked what he called the mirage of social justice. Alan quoted from that book a few minutes ago. And he also wrote a book in the 1980s. This was his last book, and it's called The Fatal Conceit. And he has a section on social justice in there. And in that book, The Fatal Conceit, this is why I didn't get angry at Alan, because I'm not quoting from Law, Legislation, and Liberty. But in The Fatal Conceit, Hayek calls the word social a weasel word. And lists, you look at the pages, he's got these columns. There's 160 nouns that he had found that writers had modified with the adjective social. And you know some of these words, a contract, security, insurance, and of course, justice. Now, one of Hayek's conclusions is that the word social has the power to, quote, empty the nouns it qualifies of their meaning. And he uses the analogy of this is why calls it a weasel word. He talks about the weasel who can suck out the contents of an egg without leaving much of a mark on the egg. So by the time the word social has done its work, there's nothing left of the original noun, and it's turned into something completely different. And he says the worst examples of this at the time that he was writing were happening in Germany, and he gives several examples of that. But you're all familiar with the way the phrase social democracy is used today. It's basically like big welfare state, which really doesn't necessarily have anything to do with democracy. So Hayek's view is that we should be on our guard whenever we hear somebody use the word social in that way. The social contract doesn't have anything to do with real contracts. Social security has nothing to do with real security. And when it comes to social justice, Hayek flat out calls it, quote, a semantic fraud from the same stable as people's democracy. But y'all are old enough to know what a people's democracy is, right? Some of you guys in the back may not know, but ask one of the older people later. So the way Hayek views it is simply a smokescreen for leftists to kind of smuggle in their own assumptions and redefine normal vocabulary. So what's his response then to say, well, what about these social outcomes that are generated by markets that we don't like? When people try their best to, but they fail to achieve what we think they deserve, because that's the outcome of markets, right? Not everybody gets what they deserve in the way we think about it. You know, somebody might try really hard, you know, start a business or do whatever, and then just has a string of bad luck or circumstances beyond their control cause failure. And, you know, is that fair? Is that just? And Hayek does have a response to this. And it's similar to the quote that Alan read a few minutes ago. He says, it's probably true that people would be happier about their economic conditions if they felt that the relative positions of individuals were just. Yet the whole idea behind distributive justice, the idea that each individual ought to receive what he morally deserves, is meaningless in the extended order of human cooperation. Because the available product, the size and even its existence, depends on what is, in one sense, a morally indifferent way of allocating its parts. For reasons already explored, moral desert cannot be determined objectively, and in any case, the adaptation of the larger whole to facts yet to be discovered requires that we accept that success is based on results, not on motivation. All right, so he's saying, this is what Alan alluded to earlier, society is really big and it's really complex and we never have all the information that we need in order to predict outcomes or to account for all the variables. And so people make mistakes as they are going through and taking action. And there's no morality necessarily that's part of that. It would be great if we all had perfect information, but that's not the way the world works. And so we have to be prepared for the possibility that we will fail because things that we did not know about, we did not take into account. And that's just reality. He says, any extended system of cooperation must adapt itself constantly to changes in its natural environment, which included the life, health, and strength of its members. The demand that only changes with just effect should occur is ridiculous. It is nearly as ridiculous as the belief that deliberate organization of response to such changes can be just. Mankind could neither have reached nor could now maintain its present numbers without an inequality that is neither determined by nor reconcilable with any deliberate moral judgments. All right, that's really important. We could not have gotten to the point where we are in terms of prosperity and even just the number of human beings that our economy can support if we had taken this approach that only people can only get what they deserve. The level of wealth that we enjoy and prosperity would not have materialized had we taken that approach. Effort, of course, will improve individual chances, but it alone cannot secure results. The envy of those who have tried just as hard, although fully understandable, works against the common interest. Thus, if the common interest is really our interest, we must not give in to this very human instinctual trait, but instead allow the market process to determine the reward. Nobody can ascertain, save through the market, the size of an individual's contribution to the overall product. Nor can it otherwise be determined how much remuneration must be tendered to someone to enable him to choose the activity which will add most to the flow of goods and services offered at large. Of course, if the latter should be considered morally good, then the market turns out to produce a supremely moral result. In other words, if we think that it is good to have a prosperous society that can sustain the material needs of so many people, then the outcomes of that market process, even if we don't like what happens in particular instances, the cumulative effect of it, we would have to say, is a moral thing. Now, again, that's not to say, I don't think Hayek is precluding the idea that when we see someone who has really worked hard, what in a previous century would be called, you know, the deserving poor, right? People who have gotten, fallen on hard times through no fault of their own, and have dependents and have just had a string of bad luck or whatever. There's nothing that precludes people from going and helping those people who are suffering in those circumstances and trying to get them back on their feet and getting them into, you know, whatever is required, a new job or career, anything like that. I don't think Hayek is saying that would be inappropriate. But I think what he is saying is that for you to say, our system is unjust and therefore we must redesign it from top to bottom in order to make sure that we never have these kinds of outcomes, he says, not only is that just a nonsensical way to think, but you'll probably end up killing a lot of people if you do that. Because the level of subsistence that we enjoy now is dependent on this system, and it is the system that has proven, experience has proven, to be the most productive. All right, so this is, I think, is a pretty powerful critique of this leftist notion of social justice. And another point that he makes here, and I'm going to close here shortly, I know we're running short on time, but Hayek also points out that, doesn't it seem a bit counterintuitive for us to say that the actions of individuals in their daily lives could be, you know, perfectly innocent and perfectly legitimate, yet the cumulative impact of millions of people doing perfectly innocent things adds up to these gigantic injustices that we then require, you know, the state to come in and fix? So that's a really counterintuitive argument to make. And it doesn't have anything to do with what we would consider regular old justice, right? You're talking about a whole different category of thinking when you make that kind of argument. And so I think Hayek would argue, and I would agree with him, that you've got to come up with a better argument. That's a hard sell to make. You've got to come up with a really compelling reason for why we should entertain that, that counterintuitive belief. Okay, so what do we do with this phrase, social justice? Is it useful at all? And as Alan mentioned, a few years ago, I contributed essays to a symposium titled Christian Faith and Social Justice that was published by Bloomsbury Academic Press. And so right off the bat, the title should tell you that it was called Christian Faith and Social Justice, Five Views. All right, so that should tell you that there's not a consensus on what this phrase means. All right, there's lots of different arguments and perspectives about this phrase, social justice. Now, the perspectives that were offered in the book were Rawlsian liberalism, feminism, liberation theology, virtue ethics, and libertarianism. So I'll let you guess which one I wrote. There were other perspectives like utilitarianism that were not even included. So there's even beyond those five, there are several others that could have made it into the volume, but ultimately were not included. So each of the contributors to this book wrote a foundational essay, and then all the other contributors wrote responses to each other. So it was an interesting exchange, and I did learn a lot by participating in that symposium. But to me, the most interesting things about that process were that, first of all, most of them seemed to willfully misunderstand the position that I was advancing with the other contributors. And then secondly, they were all telling each other, your idea of social justice is crazy. It's woefully deficient. And so nobody could agree. And I was making an argument that was pretty similar to Hayek's, and saying that if we are going to involve the state in what we're talking about, social justice, we need to limit ourselves to examining the processes that we're employing to get to the various outcomes. And we can't just judge the outcomes and say, well, that's socially unjust. And so as long as a particular social outcome is arrived at through a just process, then that would fit the criteria for a socially just outcome, even though it might not be the outcome we would all like to see. We can still take action to change that outcome, but it's not an unjust outcome. So if we are going to, the problem is nobody wants to use the phrase social justice that way, it seems, in popular discourse. So if we're going to have to use the phrase social justice, which, you know, I was arguing that let's just have justice, right? Let's just have regular justice and not have the separate category of social justice. But if we're going to have to use the phrase social justice, I would recommend trying to recover that older conservative idea of people like Topperelli and saying that social justice is not just something that the state does. Social justice can come from many sources. Families can provide social justice. They're sources of that. Churches provide social justice. Voluntary associations, mutual aid organizations, charities, unions, trade associations, these are all providers of social justice. And markets provide social justice in a very important way. And of course, you could argue that the state has a role to play in social justice as well by making sure we have a level playing field and having courts to adjudicate disputes and police to ensure law and order. I mean, all that can be part of your vision of social justice. But I think that if conservatives are going to use the phrase in a productive way, then we're going to have to go back to that older idea of social justice as being a polycentric thing. All right. Thank you for your attention.